ever. It's live, it's on location, and it's After Hours. Come join the entire After Hours crew on December 20th at O Houston, midnight to 4 a.m.
So come on out, show your support for KPFT's After Hours.
Listen to KPFT to win tickets and a pass to be a special co-host for the evening.
Come party the night away. After all, it's Christmas. It's also After Hours.
And remember, it's live. It's O Houston, Saturday, December 20th, and it's KPFT After Hours.
O Houston is located at 710 Pacific Street in the heart of Montrose. Call for tickets or information at 713-523-0213.
You listen to KPFE, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT. But be warned, that fantastic feeling will soon follow. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. It's 43 chilling degrees here in Houston. It is Queer Voices, and tonight we are going to be talking to incumbent City Councilperson District D, Ada Edwards. And also in the second hour, we have a great queer music heritage show. It's the Glam Glitter Punk Rock Edition. It sounds really good with people like Patti Smith and Lou Reed. Also in the first hour, though, we'll be talking about the marriage through This Way Out, both a news wrap and a special segment on that. But first, we go to London for the BBC News Live.
BBC News with Paul Jenkinson. The United States has reached a compromise with Britain, France, and Germany over a resolution on Iran's nuclear program to be discussed at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna on Wednesday. There had been deadlock over the proposed resolution following an IAEA report which said Iran had concealed uranium enrichment and plutonium reprocessing programs. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna, where the IAEA is based.
A Western diplomat told the BBC that a resolution on Iran's nuclear program has now been tabled. It will be discussed by the IAEA's Board of Governors on Wednesday. He said the text of the resolution should be acceptable to all of the board's 35 members. It's taken 5 days of intensive and high-level negotiations to reach agreement on how to respond to 18 years of failures by Iran to declare all of its nuclear activities. These include the production of plutonium. The United States, which accuses Tehran of trying to secretly develop nuclear weapons, had taken a hard line. But Britain, France, and Germany were concerned that such a response might alienate Iran, which has shown increased cooperation with the IAEA in recent weeks.
The United States-appointed Governing Council in Iraq has submitted a timetable to return the country to self-rule. In a letter to the United Nations Security Council, it asks for a new resolution recognizing its goal of ending the US-led occupation. Greg Barrow reports from New York.
The letter confirms a timetable worked out earlier this month during meetings between officials of the Iraqi Governing Council and representatives of the American and British governments. The letter, written by the current president of the Iraqi Governing Council, Jalal Talabani, confirms the intention to elect a new transitional government before the end of June next year, and that this body will then make preparations for a constitutional convention and ultimately general elections before the end of 2005. Mr. Talabani notes in his letter that in the light of the new circumstances, it's become appropriate for the Security Council to adopt a new resolution. Although council diplomats are discussing this possibility, at this stage, views on what may be required differ widely.
President Bush has signed legislation that authorizes him to spend more than $400,000 million on defense in the coming year, saying U.S. armed forces were engaged in a great and historic task to confront the forces of terrorism. The defense bill, which was approved by Congress earlier this month, includes more than $9 billion for ballistic missile defense and money to develop new types of nuclear weapons. You're listening to the news from the BBC. The former president of Georgia, Edward Shevardnadze, has said he has no plans to leave the country. He thanked Germany for an invitation to live there, but said he felt compelled to stay in his homeland. He resigned on Sunday after weeks of protests following elections, which opposition supporters and international observers condemned as flawed. Sarah Rainsford reports.
After the heady euphoria, the sober reality in Georgia. The interim leadership facing the challenges ahead. Acting President Nino Buchanadze has called for calm, anxious to prevent the country sliding into chaos. And as she plans for fresh elections, Mrs. Buchanadze has appealed to the international community for moral and financial support. There's a gaping hole in the budget here. Georgia prides itself on this velvet revolution. Now the deposed leader himself, Edward Shevardnadze, has announced he'll stay in his homeland.
The Argentine government says it will investigate a prosecutor's report of frequent links between government departments and criminal gangs. The report said since 1997 there'd been some 4,000 ingoing or outgoing phone calls between government departments and lines linked to criminal gangs under investigation. The chief prosecutor of Buenos Aires said suspicion centered on staff who'd worked for the Argentine government for years rather than a particular administration. The American-based lobby group Human Rights Watch has accused the Sudanese government and international oil companies of displacing hundreds of thousands of people to allow oil exploration in the south of the country. The 750-page report investigated the role of oil in Sudan's 20-year civil war, linking the exploitation of natural resources with human rights abuses. The French Justice Minister Dominique Perben has ordered a juror to be dismissed at a court in Bobigny because she was wearing a headscarf. Mr. Perben said the scarf was a sign of potential partiality and he didn't want any ostentatious sign of religious commitment to be seen in courts.
It's too.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Falinski.
And I'm Joan Devlin.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
Well, we got a lot of things going on this evening, and we're going to try to fit everything in because there's a great
queer music
heritage.
Let me
try it again.
QMH, whatever you want to do.
Right. I should try being on the radio. In the second hour, which is about glam, glitter, punk rock, right up my alley, so I'll enjoy that. But in the first hour, we're going to be talking to Ada Edwards, who's our incumbent city council person for District D. She ran unopposed, and she won. So she'll be on in a little while, but we also are going to be covering the marriage issue, which is an incredible thing going on with Massachusetts Supreme Court sort of ordering the state legislature to be able to have gay people get married or something in that respect. I do a bi-weekly newsletter, and if you're interested in getting a copy of it via email, you can go to the Queer Music website, which is on the Queer Voices
website,
queervoices.org, and sign up for it, and you'll get a copy of it. There's a whole bunch of really interesting articles that talks about this, and we're going to try to get one in here with Glenn reading it if we have time this evening. If not, we'll do it next week.
Yeah, and given the nature of this program, let's emphasize that that's twice a week, not that it's a newsletter about bisexuality.
Oh, okay.
Although there's probably some of that in there.
Probably.
So that's all that's going on. There's a couple great films going on. Now, Girls Will Be Girls, playing at Landmarks Greenway Plaza. Which is really pretty good. A couple other really good films. If you get to see Elephant playing at the Angelica downtown. Ronda wanted to remind you also that early voting is going on for the runoff for the city election. And it was so nice of the Republicans to send me a little pamphlet telling me when it is. It happens Tuesday and Wednesday.
Did they tell you how to vote too?
Yes, of course they did.
Of course they did.
Just do the opposite of what they tell you to do.
I voted for colors.
Tuesday, yes. Well, green, white, and brown.
And Parker.
Parker, right. And then if you're in the Heights, there's also Adrian Garcia. Now, green was not endorsed by the caucus, but, that's fine. You vote for who you want to vote. And also, the caucus has endorsed Michael Gomez for HIS District Number 3. So it's Bill White for mayor, Anise Parker for controller, Peter Brown for at-large Number 3, Adrian Garcia for District H, and that pretty much covers everything. But the early voting goes on this week, tomorrow from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. and Wednesday. There's no early voting on Thursday or Friday because of the holidays. Saturday and Sunday between 1 and 6 p.m. and Monday and Tuesday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And then the election is on the 6th on Saturday. If you want more information on this, you can go to our website, queervoices.org, and it will link you to the county's website, which has all the voter information on it, or the political caucus for the endorsement card. So, with all that being said, let's listen to News Wrap from this week out.
Well, I should also remind you that there is a freeze warning for tonight. Tomorrow will be a lot better. It'll be the low temperature will be in the 50s. But if you're planning on heating your house this evening by setting stuff on fire with your space heater, please be sure that you have a working smoke detector. Otherwise, fire department will gripe at you. And also remember remember to pee-pee, which means to bring your pipes
plants
inside.
Plants and pipes.
Yeah, bring your pipes inside, wrap your pets, and smoke your plants.
Okay.
I'm Sid Creed.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With an expanded edition of News Wrap for the week ending November 22nd, 2003. It seems inevitable that the United States' first legal gay and lesbian marriages will be performed in 6 months in Massachusetts, following a ruling by the state's top court this week that will significantly impact the entire nation. A 4-3 majority of Massachusetts' Supreme Judicial Court declared that, barring an individual from the protections, benefits, and obligations of civil marriage solely because that person would marry a person of the same sex violates the Massachusetts Constitution. With a nod to the top court in the Canadian province of Ontario, Massachusetts' highest court has now defined marriage there as the voluntary union between two persons. That goes beyond previous U.S. decisions supporting same-gender marriage by the state Supreme Courts of Hawaii and Vermont. It appears to require full marriage equality in Massachusetts, and the gay and lesbian plaintiffs there won't settle for some alternative recognition of civil unions or domestic partnerships. As the state's highest court ruling on state law, there is no further judicial appeal.
The court did not order that marriage licenses immediately be issued to the plaintiff couples who'd previously been denied them. The Massachusetts justices stayed the impact of their ruling for 6 months to allow the legislature to take action, but it seems that only an amendment to the state constitution can actually stop gays and lesbians from marrying in Massachusetts, and that process would take at least 2 years. So it appears that, at least for a matter of months, the state of Massachusetts will be issuing valid marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples.
These first U.S. same-gender marriages will set the stage for the first courtroom tests of laws now explicitly prohibiting the recognition of such marriages in 37 of the 50 states and of the 1996 federal so-called Defense of Marriage Act, known as DOMA. This lends fuel to the current religious right proposal to further ban gay and lesbian marriages with the so-called Federal Marriage Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, an effort that's expected to be a major feature of the 2004 presidential campaign. Republican U.S. President George W. Bush quickly responded with a statement that marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman. Today's decision of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court violates this important principle. I will work with congressional leaders and others to do what is legally necessary to defend the sanctity of marriage. As the usually staid Wall Street Journal put it, the culture wars just went nuclear.
The case, known as Goodrich versus Department of Health, referring to the state agency administering marriage laws, was brought by 7 gay and lesbian couples who had first sought and been denied marriage licenses in various Massachusetts jurisdictions. They were represented by GLAAD, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, the group that won the Vermont State Supreme Court decision that led to the creation of the United States' first civil unions. The Massachusetts ruling acknowledged that our decision marks a change in the history of marriage law. That may have been part of the reason the panel took 4 months more than its customary self-imposed time limit to issue its findings.
Chief Justice Margaret Marshall wrote for the majority, "The question before us is whether, consistent with the Massachusetts Constitution, the Commonwealth may deny the protections, benefits, and obligations conferred by civil marriage to two individuals of the same sex who wish to marry. We conclude that it may not." The decision itself described the Massachusetts Constitution as more protective of individual liberty and equality than the federal Constitution, perhaps demanding broader protections for fundamental rights and less tolerant of government intrusion into the protected spheres of private life. The court held that the state constitution forbids the creation of second-class citizens. The majority declared that our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. The marriage ban works a deep and scarring hardship on a very real segment of the community for no rational reason.
Adding the state's arguments describing hetero-exclusive marriage as a favorable setting for procreation and child-rearing, the court's majority said, it is the exclusive and permanent commitment of the marriage partners to one another, not the begetting of children, that is a sine qua non of civil marriage. The state also asserted that it was defending the institution of marriage, but the court's majority responded that the plaintiffs seek only to be married, not to undermine the institution of marriage. The decision found that the state has failed to identify any constitutionally adequate reasons for denying civil marriage to same-sex couples.
The three dissenting justices all joined in their three separate opinions on different themes, all focused on legal concerns and worded in a manner respectful of gays and lesbians. Primarily, they all emphasized that, as Justice Francis Spina put it, the power to regulate marriage lies with the legislature, not with the judiciary. But Spina also denied that there is any marriage discrimination, since each plaintiff is free to marry a willing person of the opposite sex.
Justice Robert Cordy's dissent acknowledged that it may be desirable for many reasons to extend to same-sex couples the benefits and burdens of civil marriage, and the plaintiffs have made a powerfully reasoned case for that extension. But he wrote that the state marriage statute historically referred to one man and one woman, and asserted that that passed constitutional muster because the legislature could rationally conclude that it furthers the legitimate state purpose of ensuring, promoting, and supporting an optimal structure for the bearing and raising of children.
Justice Martha Sosman noted that scientific research has yet to yield clear findings on the outcome of parenting by gay and lesbian couples relative to heterosexual marriage, and wrote, as a matter of social history, today's opinion may represent a great turning point that many will hail as a tremendous step toward a more just society. As a matter of constitutional jurisprudence, however, the case stands as an aberration.
But for the plaintiffs and their attorneys, the ruling was a victory to savor, and they shared their celebration with reporters. Attorney Mary Botto of Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders.
It's obviously an historic day, November 18th, 2003. And it's an historic day because finally, all families in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will have the opportunity to be equal families under the law. We all know that civil marriage is this enormous government construct. It's the most comprehensive protections for families that exists. What comes along with it are hundreds of real bread and butter protections for families and protections in times of tragedy and crisis and emergency. Some court has finally had the courage to say this really is an issue about human equality and human dignity, and it's time that the government treat these people fairly.
Plaintiff couple Gloria Bailey and Linda Davies.
Without a doubt, this is the happiest day in our lives.
I finally asked her to marry me because she told me she couldn't answer until we could legally do it. And I'm happy to tell the world, she said, yes.
Plaintiff Mike Horgan.
Today, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Ed and I are finally full and equal citizens.
Plaintiff Hillary Goodrich told ABC TV's Nightline how her daughter inspired their marriage activism when then 6-year-old Annie was asked to name people who loved each other.
And she listed off a whole group of people, and I realized each one of these groupings were heterosexual married couples. And so I said to Annie, well, what about Ma and Mummy? Don't we love each other? And she said, you don't love each other. I said, what do you mean? And she said, if you loved each other, you'd be married.
Hillary's partner, Julie Goodrich, at that celebratory press conference.
Thank you to the Supreme Judicial Court of the state of Massachusetts for seeing what we know to be true, which is that we are a couple that is worthy of the protections of marriage, and that after 16 and a half years, Hillary and I are finally going to be able to get married and protect our family.
Gays and lesbians elsewhere joined the celebration, most notably in San Francisco, where a rally in the heavily gay Castro district led to a 5-block parade by some 200 people wearing everything from wedding gowns to Boston Red Sox baseball team gear.
But for Massachusetts politicians, the decision poses a heavy burden. The state's Republican governor, Mitt Romney, no supporter of same-gender marriage, declared,
"We obviously have to follow the law as provided by the Supreme Judicial Court. Even if we don't agree with it, we're going to follow it in terms of preparing legislation, and we'll have legislation which conforms with the law. But we will at the same time initiate a constitutional amendment process, and that constitutional amendment process will be consistent with what I think the feelings are of the people of the Commonwealth, and of course, the entire sweep of recorded history."
Massachusetts Representative Phil Travis is a Democrat, but he was already working towards a state constitutional amendment to prohibit same-gender marriage and is now intensifying those efforts. He told reporters,
"I am in no quick hurry to condone the action of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. I think it flies in the face of what we know in Massachusetts as marriage and have demonstrated since our founding."
Democratic Massachusetts House Speaker Tom Finneran also supports an amendment against same-gender marriages and has steadily opposed legal domestic partnerships.
Romney, Democratic Attorney General Thomas Riley, and some leading state lawmakers believe they can create what the governor referred to as a civil union-type provision that will satisfy the state's high court. Most legal experts disagree, and any such move would definitely be challenged in court by the current plaintiffs and GLAD. From the other side, if a civil union law were enacted quickly, a repeal initiative could be placed before the voters as early as November 2004. Massachusetts lawmakers are already being deluged with communications protesting same-gender marriage in a campaign organized by religious right groups.
Meanwhile, the Romney administration quickly advised all Massachusetts municipalities that no marriage licenses should be issued to gay and lesbian couples during the 180-day stay the court imposed on its own ruling. The only town that seemed to have a problem with that was Cambridge, where some city council members appeared eager to make it the site of the nation's first same-gender marriage. But GLAD and other gay and lesbian activists have also publicly asked them to withhold licenses for the court's waiting period.
Massachusetts noted pioneered program supporting lesbian gay youth in its public schools. A number of open gays and lesbians have been elected to office there, most notably Democratic U.S. Congress member Barney Frank. Frank said in a debate with religious conservative Jerry Falwell on CNN,
"When Vermont did civil unions, there were all kinds of predictions of chaos and marriages dissolving. None of those have proven to be the case. If you're a heterosexual living in Vermont today, civil unions have no effect on you whatsoever. And I think by 2006, people will see that in Massachusetts as well."
But it's also a state with a large Roman Catholic population, and the state's leading Catholic clergy have for months been speaking out themselves against legal recognition of same-gender couples and calling on Catholics to actively oppose it as well.
A Pew poll taken in October found that overall about 60% of Americans oppose equal marriage rights for same-gender couples, compared to about 32% supporting them. One unnamed Democratic strategist was quoted by the Wall Street Journal as saying, "We knew the Supreme Court would do anything to help reelect Bush. We just didn't know it would be the Supreme Court of Massachusetts."
Numerous state-level politicians across the U.S. also reacted to the Massachusetts ruling, many moving to enact laws or constitutional amendments to block any recognition of or moves toward same-gender marriages.
And finally, given the polling against same-gender marriage and the religious right campaign for the federal marriage amendment against it, the gay and lesbian advocacy group Human Rights Campaign this month launched a $1 million print ad campaign to put a face on the issue. One of the five original ads featured Massachusetts plaintiff couple the Goodridges and ran in newspapers there. HRC's ads are earnest and affecting in making their case for the benefits and protections of marriage for gay and lesbian families. But they might take a tip from their counterparts in Canada to use a lighter touch. The first married gay couple there, Kevin Barassa and Joe Varnell of Toronto, have taken the lead in a massive, largely volunteer effort to put together three broadcast ads supporting same-gender marriage. The theme chosen by Toronto ad agency Zig for the campaign is "What's Wrong with Gay Marriage?"
Never remembers our anniversary.
My mother-in-law.
I guess our religious differences.
Teeth grinding in the middle of the night.
Leaving dirty clothes on our bedroom floor.
So cheap.
My mother-in-law.
Talks way too loud.
Leaving the cap off the toothpaste.
I never have any covers at night.
My mother-in-law.
Snoring.
Whenever I go to drive the car, the tank's empty.
Always late.
My mother-in-law.
You know what's wrong with gay marriages? The same things that are wrong with straight ones. Support same-sex marriage. A message from PFLAG and EqualMarriage.ca.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 22nd, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm John Beaupre. This is Queer Voices.
Ada Edwards is with us this evening. She is councilperson for District D, which includes Montrose and the Southeast region. Why don't you describe it a little bit better, Ed?
Well, Jack, thanks for having me here again.
And like, you're no stranger to KPFK.
Well, I mean, but it's still good to be, you know, kind of like all over the dial, now, just in one little part. But District D geographically is 144 square miles. It's the same size as the city of Atlanta. And it starts in the Montrose area and goes through the Medical Center, the Museum District, part of Third Ward, then Sunnyside, South Park, and then Hiram Clark, Windsor Village area, and then all the way out to Missouri City.
The other interesting thing about a district council person is that they represent about half the size of a congressional district.
Exactly.
Which is pretty big.
Pretty big, pretty yes. Awesome. And the interesting thing, one of the things that we found when we first got into office, first of all, let me give my thanks to constituents of District D for rehiring me for two more years.
Without an opponent. Pretty incredible.
And we had such an awesome turnout. We had, final count was close to 40,000 people. A little over 40,000 people vote in the district for this last general election, which according to the county taxpayers office and registrar was the third highest district voting standard that was not tied to presidential election.
Wow.
So we're very, very proud. And it was very necessary because it kind of gives me kind of a scoring card as to whether or not we're on the right track in the office and trying to do the work for the people who've hired us. So thank you very much. With that, I think it sends a very clear mandate that we need to make sure that we show up again for the runoff, because if I'm to work and continue the projects that we're working on in the district, then I need people on council who can assist me in that and at least have at least a core value system that says I am for health issues. It's hard, Jack, to push things about HIV and Hep C and all that when you have sitting council members who tell you, well, you know, Ada, I'm not really sure if everybody has a right to health care.
It's pretty incredible. It's just like the health care issue that's going through the Congress right now. Mm-hmm. They're just throwing money at the corporations,
right,
but not really solving any of the problems.
The whole issue, how, you know, George Bush started this whole thing about he was going to send all these billions of dollars to Africa. One, it hasn't started about HIV. And then two, when you look at the configuration of how it's going to be, close to 75 to 80% is going to wind up in the pharmaceutical hands and not to the people on the ground. So it's the same kind of attitude. So I'm very concerned that we have people coming onto council in January that are concerned about public health, about standing up to the plate and making sure that we aggressively carve out and develop ways that we can administer public health, not only from a primary care or acute care, but from a prevention.
Well, and also, it's my understanding that the state has cut off health care to a lot of children.
Right. Well, they've reestablished some of it. They could have reestablished all of it because Perry has a multi-billion dollar slush fund that he can do whatever he wants to do with it. And so that's how some of that was reestablished. But mental health, which is very critical for not only children, but anybody living in this society today, dental health, and there's one, I think it's vision, we're still not reinvigorated with the reinstatement of some of the CHIP program. And the interesting thing about that whole issue, Jack, is that these are not people who are not, these aren't slackers. These are people who are working, working poor or almost working poor people who depend upon their tax dollar being maximized to help them walk their daily walk in the community. That's why they pay taxes. That's the lie that says when you pay taxes through either your paycheck or through buying a soda at the store, whatever way you contribute to the tax pool, that you get a return that you can quantify. And basically, we don't. And the city of Houston is the only municipality that has cut the tax base within the last 10 years. The county is sitting on a surplus, and they're still raising people's appraisal values on their houses to where it's just out the roof. And then the state, you're sitting at a $4 billion deficit, and nobody's saying, well, you know, Perry is really stupid. We really need to get rid of him. And so my question is for our citizens is that all politics start on a local level.
Right.
And with term limits, you're always the junior partner at the table because you're up against people who have districts that they've been in for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And when you come in with 2 years and you go like, hey, what's your name? You're always at a disadvantage. And so when we're always at a disadvantage on the local level, then we will always get chumped when we pay, when we look trying to get the reinvestment on our tax dollars. We pay more as a citizen of Houston to Harris County than we get returned. You understand what I'm saying? Of a Harris County dollar tax, we pay, the citizens of Houston pay almost approximately something like 63% of that dollar tax. But 80% of the services go to the suburbs.
Interesting. Outside the city limits. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And I guess on that subject, you were talking before we went on the air that the Sunnyside District has not had a new school building in over 30 years.
Well, it's not only the Sunnyside. It's a larger proportion. You're looking at 3rd Ward, Sunnyside, South Union, in that area. It's, I think it's District 4, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't want to say that because I wasn't clear on it's either 4 or 9. But that's a real concrete return on your tax dollars. Those people are being taxed all the time, and then they're always given the excuse as to why it cannot happen.
Yeah, and leave no child behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're not saying that all things can be equal, because that's very hard to do, but things can be equitable. And I think that 30 years is enough time where you can get at least one new school building and not just always these modular buildings or trailer type situations. The other issue that's a major piece for District D has been the drainage fee. And we, being the office, we established a District D Advisory Council, which has representatives from the whole district, from Montrose to Missouri City. And their charge was to their charge is to help me decide how to vote on issues like the drainage fee. So they went through all of the whole machinations of what is the drainage fee, why is it a fee as opposed to being a tax. And that was very purposeful, because a fee would allow for everybody to have equitable participation in solving the problem.
Okay.
Since we all contribute to the problem. A tax would have made the burden even more burdensome on the taxpayer, that being primarily the homeowner, because then you get into all the exemptions of churches and da da yada 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 yada. And it was never looked at in the sense of, for District D, of the projects that were going online regarding drainage. And when we're talking drainage, Jack, we're not talking street flooding. The streets are designed to flood to an extent to keep the waters out of your house.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we're talking about under the ground, the drainage, the infrastructure that allows for the sewage not to back up into your kitchen and back up into your bathroom, back into your backyard, that allows for, that stops all the potholes and so forth, because of we are a flat terrain, and we've had so much undisciplined building.
Exactly.
And the more concrete you lay, the more water is going to be running. So tied to the drainage fee was a development structure that would circumvent a lot of the loopholes that developers have been using regarding putting in detention ponds and those types of things. And also tied to the drainage fee was that it was sole purpose, which was meant that that's the only thing that it could be used for. And that it had an operation and maintenance component that provided for an ongoing maintenance. We have infrastructure in this city that has not been maintained in over 30 years.
Right. And, you know, we have, like last Monday, it rained like crazy.
Right. And a lot of the flooding that people had, who, you know, that called the office and say, you know, I've been in this house for 20 years.
Yes.
It never flooded before. Now, every time it spits, I flood. And that's because of the unfeathered development that has been allowed to go on, because for whatever reason, people in this city are afraid of zoning. And as long as we don't have zoning, then we have got to have a mechanism by which we can mitigate, you know, undisciplined development And then for those people that do want to put a lot of concrete, then you've got to help us solve the problem, what that concrete develops. So I was very disappointed. I thought the administration took a very brave stand and keep pushing this, because it is not a glamour shot for a politician. It's not, you don't get your name put up on a drainage pump. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't become the stadium or the arenas or whatever. But a classic example of what it does mitigate, do you remember the Almeida sinkhole?
Yes, for like a year. Yes.
Yeah, and it was that involved and that invasive, and it's still going on because it was had more tentacles. But we had reports in our office from that were dated in the 1980s. That said, this is a problem and you need to fix it. And no one wanted to bite the bullet, because you don't get a lot of kudos for that.
Right, and in 6 years you'll be out of office. Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly. So how does this fit into my resume? And so you don't deal with long-range planning. So at the end of the day, because we didn't deal with it when it was minor, then it became major, and now we're dealing with it in a, on a $10 million basis, plus the ongoing work that's going out there. So it goes back to the old adage of, you can pay me now or you can pay me later. But the taxpayers can eventually have to pay, because that's the only revenue the city has.
Right. One of the other big issues, of course, is transportation, traffic. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're dealing also here in this district with the 527 spur.
Right.
And there's only so much the city can do, but is there an answer for that? When they close it down, and the traffic has to go somewhere.
Well, right now, it's looking at, TxDOT, in my opinion, has a very arrogant and ignorant position. Once again, we're dealing with studies that date the 1980s, when this area was different demographically and also institutionally. Now, the issue for us, though, and we were talking with Jim Blackburn regarding this, about possibly the environmental study that they're dealing with is 1985, which is completely out of date and out of step with what's happening in 2003. There are some other issues that I'm not going to get into, but we do feel like we do have a leg, perhaps in court, to stop it. But we're also looking at working. We had a meeting today with the Metro leadership, with Chairman Hector and CEO President DeLibrio, talking with Jim Blackburn as to how we can mitigate and use some of the Metro park and ride facilities and the new light rail and so forth to encourage people to not to even come on into downtown, but to get to a point outside of the loop or right inside the loop around Reliance Stadium. There's a lot of parking that isn't used during the week. Mm-hmm. You can't dump 4,000 cars per hour on Alabama and Richmond. You just can't do it. You cannot do it. It is a public safety nightmare, and it's just accidents waiting to happen. And TxDOT's position is, that's your problem, because we're going to do this anyway.
And it needs to be done. I mean, the highways need to be rebuilt.
Well, they need to be rebuilt, according to the engineers from the city, and I'm not an engineer, so I take at least little credence in what they say, that the plan that TxDOT is trying to force down the throat will not even mitigate the problem that they say is the problem.
Right, right.
And so, and then plus the other factor is that there's no synergy to the construction projects that are going on. There's a project that's going on now on Kirby. So what's, I mean,
right.
You know, there's,
yes,
there
yes.
needs to be what, some coordination and some thought given to this.
And my favorite is that, you know, they somehow seem to work out moving traffic when they do construction somewhat, but they don't give any consideration for pedestrians.
Well, their whole attitude is that traffic will find its own level, like water. Like, people will eventually find that they can go past your house instead of, you know.
You're right.
Yeah. But they don't give any consideration to residents. And the resident population in this area, especially on Alabama and Richmond, has changed drastically.
Right.
We have more pedestrian usage of those areas. We have more school children and so forth in those areas. And you cannot dump 4,000 cars on those areas.
Right. And we also have people who like to ride their bicycle.
Thank you.
Which helps out the environment.
It's a more pedestrian user community than it was when they did their study. But regardless, or as my grandmother would say, irregardless, you still need to do a study that is more up to date and more germane than 1985.
We're talking to Councilperson Ada Edwards, who's in District D, reelected without an opponent, and so that means two more years that you're going to be in office. What about the environment? What can be done to, I mean, you know, Houston has this reputation around the country in many ways of being a, you know, dirty city, polluted city, somewhat wrongly, somewhat, you know, truly.
Well, I think there's some truth to it, and one of the things that I was disappointed in the light rail discussion, that it was, that it became the discussion instead of transportation, and that light rail being a component of it. But transportation got subsumed into the conversation of light rail, which is, to me, is stupid. But we have got to have discussions, I think, on two levels, broader and deeper. We need to start having discussions, and we're trying to do this in a district now with school children to get them tied into the concept of what is mass transit, and how do I factor, what does it have to do with my health? We have asthmas out the box here in this country, in the city. Autoimmune diseases that our people are challenged with are, is out of the box, that is exacerbated by the air quality and so forth. Even California, even after they, you know, they elected Schwarzenegger, but they did, were smart enough to say, we are not going to have highways being built within a certain area of schools, because we understand that that relationship between our children's health and that type of pollution. And we're dumb enough to be talking about adding 20 lanes to Katy, which will then wind up being 20 lanes to 45 and 59 and 290 and all the rest. I was in a meeting today where they're talking about redoing 288. I'm going like, let me ask you a question. Why does 288 flood, and why is it necessary to redo 288 when it was just opened in the late 80s?
Right.
And they said, well, we need to make some changes based upon transportation. I said, but isn't that why 288 was initially created, was for transportation? So what makes me think the process would be any different now than it was when you did it initially? And they just kind of looked at me like, why are you asking me that? But those are the kind of questions that they really...
Yes.
What happens if no one asks those questions and demands an answer, then the community is always at the behest of this type of what I think is